We're shifting gears now from our conversation about the NSA with my first guest to a discussion and a search for mythical, mystical creatures with one of the preeminent cryptozoologists in the world, Dr. Carl Schuchar, and some of the stories, some of the mysteries that he has tracked down. It's absolutely fascinating. We're bringing him on right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, I'm George Knapp. My next guest is Dr. Carl Schuchar. He's a zoologist, a media consultant, and science writer, one of the best-known cryptozoologists in the world. He's written 9 books. Wrong. He's written 19 books and hundreds of articles, principally about animal-related subjects, with a special interest in cryptozoology and animal mythology, the search for mythical, mystical creatures that may or may not exist. Dr. Schuchar, great to welcome you to the program for the first time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The subtitle of your new book, and I want to make sure I'm pronouncing it, Mirabilis? Okay. The subtitle is A Carnival of Cryptozoology and Unnatural History, and you sort of have the artwork on the book is kind of looks like a carnival. A traveling carnival, and it's fun. Jumps out at me is about the book. Is it really is written in not as stuffy, not as so serious. It's fun.
Yeah, that was the whole point. A good artist friend of mine, Anthony Wallace, designed the front cover, produced the beautiful artwork with the idea in mind that it was almost every chapter was like a kind of different sideshow of strange animals that you'd never heard of before and you'd probably never see again. So, yeah, that was the idea behind it.
Well, it certainly came through. And you are, as I mentioned, one of the best-known cryptozoologists in the world. You are a straightforward scientist. You adhere to scientific principles as you're having fun and chasing down these stories. I'm just curious whether you are looked at with suspicion by your fellow scientists, if whether or not cryptozoology is considered a legitimate pursuit, or if they would prefer that you just stay in the closet kind of a thing.
It used to be a lot like that, but in more recent years there's been a lot more mainstream zoological interest in cryptozoology, because I think basically so many new animals are still being discovered year in, year out. I've written an entire book, Encyclopedia of New and Rediscovered Animals, on this subject, that people are realizing that, you know, this is a very big world out there and we still haven't found everything in it. And so if we can still find very large animals, which we are still doing in the seas and on land, some of these cryptids, these mystery animals that have been reported for a long time, perhaps some of these are real as well.
It sounds like a heck of a lot of fun. I'm just curious, it wasn't clear from the book whether you get to travel around to do this stuff or whether the detective work you do is mostly in libraries or archives.
It's a bit of both. I've traveled the world over the years, but in more recent years, I've concentrated more on the bibliographical side of things, because, frankly, there is so much in the library as well as in the field. I think there's room for both sides of the cryptozoological coin. To do field work is definitely important, but you also have to be grounded in the bibliographical side. And I've always been fascinated in reading old texts and old tomes and a couple of sentences that have intrigued me, and nothing more has been said about it. And I've actually sometimes gone out into the field, sometimes gone into further libraries to find out, you know, what did those couple of sentences mean? What animal did they relate to? And some of the most extraordinary discoveries in cryptozoology have been made actually in the library rather than in the field. So, yeah, it's a bit of both, really.
And are there consequences for pursuing these topics? Here in this country, I'll just use an example, and we'll talk about Sasquatch later. But, you know, there are a couple of academics who have had the courage to want to pursue this topic, and they get shunned, they get ridiculed, they get beaten up in the media, and I just wonder if you get the same stuff.
In the past, when I first started, that did happen to a certain extent, because, as I say, cryptozoology was still very much a controversial subject. It is today, but perhaps I've been lucky, I suppose. Having the academic qualifications helps. I'm not saying you have to have them to do cryptozoological research. You don't. And some of the best, particularly the field research cryptozoologists, are people without, you know, formal qualifications, but they have a great aptitude for seeking animals in the wild, which is marvelous. So with me, perhaps I've been lucky. I haven't had so much of that. But then again, I haven't gone in great detail into some of the most controversial ones. I mean, the one that would be the most controversial for me, living in England or living in the UK, would be the Loch Ness Monster. And although I find the Loch Ness Monster a fascinating phenomenon, a fascinating subject, it's not one that I've explored in vast amounts of detail, because I've always been interested in the more unusual animals. And even though cryptozoology is by definition the more unusual animals, even within cryptozoology I've gone for the lesser known ones. Mirabilis, is the new book, is full of you won't find Loch Ness Monsters, you won't find Sasquatch, you won't find Yetis, but you will find really, really obscure mystery animals, and that's what I've always gone for.
Well, you certainly achieved it. There's creatures in here that I have never heard of, and I've been reading about this stuff for a long time. Mirabilis, you described that you have a definition of where that word came from in the book. Tell me what it means.
It basically means wonders. It's wonders or marvels, and again, that's what I've tried to encompass within the book. Mystery animals that are truly fascinating, that they are quite wonderful, nothing like you've ever heard of before.
I want to jump into the deep end of the pool with a monster that is near and dear to my heart, because these things really did roam the region where I live, the state of Nevada in the U.S. I can imagine that it wasn't that long ago, decades ago, that somebody stood in front of a scientific audience or an academic audience and described what an ichthyosaur was, and described what they must have looked like and how big they were when they roamed the seas, and people must have laughed at them. That seems ridiculous. And yet today here in Nevada, we have an ichthyosaur state park where you can see the fossilized remains of these things. Tell me about the search for truth about what an ichthyosaur is.
Well, as you know, the ichthyosaur is sea lizard from the Mesozoic era, or sea reptile, that looked very fish-like, almost like a dolphin. And when they were first discovered in England, we have lots of ichthyosaur remains. But the most famous ones came from a little town called Lyme Regis, which is on the coast of a county called Dorset. And long, long ago, hundreds of years ago, fossils of ichthyosaurs would appear in the cliff faces or would be uncovered by the sea. And people thought they were dragons. They found these remains of them. They looked huge. They were huge, monstrous, with gigantic teeth, long backbones, fins. And they had no idea back in those days of paleontology, of fossils of creatures living millions of years ago. So they thought they were the remains of sea dragons. But eventually, the kind of pre-scientists came along and started investigating these and tried to compare them with modern-day creatures to see if there's any relationship. And some people thought, oh, it must be a crocodile, and some people thought a giant lizard. But eventually, when they were fully investigated, they were found to be... they were millions of years old, and they were found to belong to a group that is now totally extinct, called which were named ichthyosaurs because of their superficially fish-like appearance. And so that was one of the first examples of the prehistoric world becoming known for what it was, rather than being mythologized as sea dragons. And the same happened with plesiosaurs. When the first plesiosaur remains came along, they were thought to be dragons. This has happened a lot. Pterodactyl remains, when they've been uncovered in cliffs and whatever, because they have wings, even more so with those, they were often thought to be the remains of dragons. So mythology eventually gave way to paleontology, and the kind of mythological creatures of our folk tales ended up becoming the monsters, the prehistoric monsters from ancient times.
Well, the ichthyosaur it has its own park, state park here in Nevada. I've stood in a museum underneath a skeleton that's been preserved and put on a wall, and its dimensions are just, they're mind-boggling. I mean, it does look like a monster.
Huge. Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, if you had absolutely, if you'd never experienced any schooling, any education concerning the prehistoric animals, and you just saw one of those creatures, you would say, you know, that's the remains of a dragon.
Here's one that's not mentioned in your book, but it has been mentioned in recent articles about ichthyosaurs, and it's called a kraken. And you know, there's these gladiator type movies, mythological movies that talk about a kraken as a monster that's unleashed by the gods, but there really was something called a kraken, right?
There was indeed. It was what we now know to be the giant squid, The Kraken was said to be in mythology. In Hollywood has combined two different mythologies here. The Clash of the Titans included the Kraken, Perseus rescuing Andromeda from the Kraken, which is actually Greek mythology meeting Norse mythology, because the Kraken was never part of Greek mythology. It was Norse, but Kraken, the idea of the Kraken, I think, was more interesting. The Greek mythological antagonist of Perseus from the sea was a large whale-like creature, and I suppose that wasn't quite as exciting as the Kraken, because the Kraken was said to be a gigantic creature, so huge that people thought when it rose above the surface of the ocean, people thought it was an island, and sailors would even go onto the surface of the creature, assuming it to be a small island as a respite, and then suddenly the gigantic tentacles would appear from beneath its body and would snatch the poor sailors to their doom, drag them underwater. And of course, this was thought to be totally, totally fairy tale, totally fabulous. But eventually, remains of these giant squids were washed ashore, and people started to examine them and realized that, you know, we knew all about little squids in the sea, but we had no idea that these monstrous creatures with enormous, you know, 20-foot-long tentacles and so forth existed. And it was realized that the mythology of the Kraken was actually, or Kraken, was actually based upon a genuine creature, the giant squid. So that was cryptozoology absolutely confirmed, a creature known to the local people and mythologized, but not known to science until the actual remains, the dead bodies, were washed ashore.
There must be an immense satisfaction at some point for the local people who describe these kinds of beings and are laughed at, and then the scientists who initially take up the cause and who do the research, and they get laughed at. And eventually it gets proven to be true. Science fiction becomes science fact, and you get to, like, just rub somebody's nose in it. There must be some satisfaction in that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, that is definitely one of the great aspects of if cryptozoology is actually proved true, a case of cryptozoology is proven to be true. Oh, I mean, that is exactly the sequence of events. In fact, there's a term called ethno-known, in which a mystery animal is said to be ethno-known if it's known to the local people but not known to science, or not recognized by science. And most of the major cryptozoological animals, by definition, are ethno-known. The locals know all about them, but science has yet to recognize their validity, their existence. But as you say, eventually, when a body normally turns up, or DNA samples confirm it differs from any known species, then the scientists recognize it does exist. Then, of course, as you say, you know, the locals and the scientists who were brave enough to investigate it can justifiably be feeling rather smug, because it was a case of, well, we did tell you.
Well, you must have felt kind of smug with the case of Trunco, and this is a white-furred, elephant-like sea monster, and there's a description in your book that sailors saw this one of these things battling in the ocean with a couple of whales, and the story must have sounded preposterous in the beginning, but it for 80 years this mystery went on, and you solved it. Tell us that story.
Yeah, I have to say I am somewhat proud of that, because Trunco was one of those creatures. It was just so weird, it couldn't possibly exist, and yet apparently it did. Trunco was said to be, I have to admit, by the way, I did actually coin the name Trunco, which I kind of cringe having done so. It was more of a joke than anything else, but he just caught on, and the media liked it, so it became Trunco. Until then, it had no name. But what he actually was, the story was, in the early 1920s, there's a town called Margate on the South African coast, and apparently one day the local people were drawn to the coast by what seemed to be a ferocious battle going on between a couple of whales and what was described as a giant white-furred, almost like a polar bear creature, with a very long trunk and a very long elephantine trunk, and it was battling these two whales. But unfortunately, according to the reports, it lost the battle, it was killed. The dead remains were washed to the shore, and this was a huge creature, said to be around 40 feet long, lying on the beach for a time, and it began to decompose, and the smell was absolutely awful, but the sea eventually washed it back out, and it was not seen again. And this, as I say, was the early 1920s. As far as anyone knew, there were no photos taken, no samples taken, so what on earth was it? It didn't fit the description of any known animal at all. And back in 2010, a friend of mine, also interested in sea creatures, was idly looking on a South African website, and lo and behold, there was a photo of what was said to be Tronco, which was, you know, quite amazing. There were not supposed to be any photos of it. And he showed it to me. Could this be genuine? And I looked at it and I said, well, it could be genuine, yes, because if it is, I know what that is. But we spent about 3-4 days pursuing this further. And lo and behold, in a Wide World magazine, the famous magazine, Wide World magazine, in the 1920s, there was a report which in 80 years no cryptozoologist had ever seen or had ever recognized it for what it was. It was a report by an actual eyewitness of Tronco who had been to the coast and had taken photos of the remains of Tronco on the beach, which this was quite sensational. We finally had photographic evidence of what Tronco was, and they were good photos, and looking at them, I could identify what it was straight away. And it was what we tend to call a globster. And a globster is a dead whale that the skeleton and the skull has sunk into the sea out of the remains of the dead whale, leaving behind just a kind of sac, a gelatinous sac containing collagen, which is a connective tissue, connective protein, and blubber. And then on the surface, there are connective tissues which look like connective fibers, which look like long white hair. So what you've basically got is a sack of blubber and protein, collagen, covered in white hair. And that is what was in the photos. It was an absolutely classic lobster. So finally, we knew what Tronco was. It wasn't some mysterious marine elephant. It was a globsterized whale. And then you say, well, if it was a globsterized whale, how come it was fighting with two living whales? Because it would be long dead. And I think the answer to that is whales, particularly killer whales, tend to play with their food. They throw it backwards and forwards in the air to one another. And I think this is what the people were seeing on the coast. They were seeing a dead, completely decomposed, globsterized whale remains being thrown backwards and forwards by two living whales, and from that distance it looked like a living creature. And of course, when it was washed ashore, it was already decomposing. That's why the terrible smell, and people just assumed it was a huge monstrous creature when in fact it was nothing more than a decomposed whale. But there was no way of knowing one way or the other until those photos turned up. And when those photos turned up, absolutely case solved, no question. That was the answer to Tronco.
And you came up with the name Tronco sort of offhand. You yep. might wish you came up with another name, but you came up with it offhand, and it stuck, right?
It did, absolutely. That'll teach me the next time to come up with a better sounding name if I'm going to name a mystery animal, yeah. But the trunk, incidentally, turned out almost definitely was nothing more than just an isolated rib covered in, again, connective tissue covered in protein that had just remained within this sack of blubber. And that was almost certainly the trunk, because it was washed ashore, the whole remains were washed ashore. Then the sea took them out. The sea actually brought them back in again a few weeks later, very briefly. And by that time, the trunk had gone. So obviously the rib had detached itself during that period back in the sea and had fallen, you know, down into the sea depths. So Tronco was trunkless after that. But there you go.
And were you able to make a presentation on this in front of skeptical colleagues and sort of rub their noses in it at some point?
Well, I did a major article in a British publication called 14 Times, which is the kind of preeminent periodical for all of these mysteries, and it attracted a great deal of attention. I've actually spoken to a scientific colleague, and we're thinking of doing this as writing the whole thing up as a formal scientific paper, because Tronco has been in the news for so long. I think it's probably time that this was presented, as you say, in a formal scientific manner.
Dr. Carl Schuker, we're talking about his research into other kinds of creatures and monsters, and the list is a pretty long one. Stay with us. We're talking with Dr. Carl Schuker, author of Mirabilis, A Carnival of Cryptozoology and Unnatural History, going down a list of a lot of really strange creatures that he's tracked down over the years. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Carl Schuker is my guest. His new book, Mirabilis, A Carnival of Cryptozoology and Unnatural History, is a cornucopia of strange and mystical and mythical creatures. Is there one that jumps out at you that's your favorite other than Tronco?
I thing, probably the subject of the first chapter, which is why it is the first chapter, that creature really does intrigue me. It's a creature which probably few other cryptozoologists have ever heard of. I'd never, ever come across it at all. It was a creature called the Sucotyro. And a colleague of mine had written to me to ask if there was such a thing as a tusked megalopedus, and which, again, I'd never heard of. And I was looking up tusked megalopedus and discovered that it was actually a fictitious creature that had appeared in a novel. And so that ended that. But while this happens a lot in cryptozoology, while I was looking up and researching this megalopedus, I came upon reports of this Sucotyro. And the Sucotyro is really odd. The story of it, very basically, is in the 17th century, a Dutch traveller reported this creature from what was then known as the East Indies. The East Indies is now Indonesia, Malaysia, Southeast Asia, basically. But the creature is represented in his book, which I won't attempt to pronounce, a very long Dutch title, but within his book there was a picture of it, and this is the only, it's an engraving, the only engraving known of the Sucotyro, and it portrays it as a very large, ox-like, almost elephant-sized animal from the island of Java in Indonesia, with a ridge of hair running along its back, four very sturdy legs, long floppy ears, a short, very short trunk, but not an elephantine one, much like a giant wild pig, a snout with two very flared nostrils. But the really extraordinary thing are the pair of tusks that it has. They look very like very long, slender elephant tusks, but they don't emerge from its jaws. They actually emerge from an area just below its eyes. So it has a pair of gigantic tusks, horizontal teeth that are coming from just below its eyes, which is obviously truly bizarre. As I say, it was supposedly from the island of Java, and it appeared, once his book had been published, it started to appear in the natural history tomes, but no one really had any idea what on earth the Sucotyro could be. And by the 18th century, people were starting to get a little sceptical. Did it even exist at all? And an English zoologist, George Shaw, was the first to actually voice considerable doubt as to its validity. And eventually, bit by bit, the Sucotyro lost its credibility and it vanished from the natural history books, which is why today I defy anyone to find a modern-day book, short of Mirabilis, that actually contains the Sucotyro. But looking at it, if you kind of strip away some of the superficial description, you have to realise that the artist who drew this creature had never seen a real one. He only had the description to go on, a verbal description. So if you take that into account and you look at it, it is a little reminiscent of a strange creature called the Babirusa. And the Babirusa is found on various Indonesian islands. It's a wild pig. It's a large wild pig, and it has the most unusual tusks. The upper tusks, instead of curving down, which any normal creatures would do, they actually grow upwards. They grow through the creature's own jaws and emerge from the top of its jaws. And with a bit of imagination, looking at the Babirusa and looking at the picture of the Sucotyro, you could see that the two are relatively similar to one another, except the Sucotyro is larger. And so is it just possible that Java once had a species of Babirusa? We now know, we thought there was only one species of Babirusa. We now know there are four closely related ones. Could there have been a fifth one that actually lived on Java, is now extinct, and as appears to have happened in cryptozoology in the past, we had a large, exotic-looking creature that sadly became extinct before science had ever really confirmed its reality, its existence. And I think that might be the answer to the Sucotyro.
Well, I like the idea that you don't completely close the door to it, that maybe it really did exist at some point, even though we don't have really solid evidence. In the book, in the chapter about the Sucotyro, you mention at the end that there was a dwarf buffalo-sized species of Stegodont, I hope I'm pronouncing that was known to have survived on the island of Flores, just east of Java, until about 12,000 years ago. You don't say it in the book, but wasn't there something else that survived until about 12,000 years ago on that island? Hobbits?
Well, yeah, the Flores is now becoming quite a hotbed of interest for cryptozoology, because, as you say, a few years ago, there was the discovery of remains of a small humanoid creature. There's been controversy as to whether it's a separate species in its own right or whether it's a kind of deformed modern-day human. There's still two schools of thought, but the prevalent one now seems to be that it was a valid miniature species of human in its own right, which has been nicknamed the Hobbit based on the J.R. Tolkien entities. And so, yeah, some of the reports from today on floors describe actual living mini humanoids called the Ebugogu, which may be modern-day hobbits that have survived to the present day, undiscovered by science. So, yeah, Flores does have quite a lot of a crypto interest, and the Sukhothara being so close to it on the island of Java adds just a little more to that possibility. And the Stegodon, as you say, is a dwarf. This particular one was a dwarf species of elephants, so perhaps, you know, dwarf elephants, dwarf humanoids, Babaroos is unknown to science on Java. It wouldn't be the first time that a certain area of the world has thrown up all sorts of cryptozoological creatures that have been shown to be true.
Well, it just is astonishing to me, and I'm using the term hobbits with air quotation marks around it,
yep.
But it
yep.
is astonishing when I remember reading this for the first time a couple of years ago, that this species could have existed 10, 12,000 years ago. I mean, modern humans were already around at
That's
that
right.
time.
Yep. Oh, yeah. This is why I say that just because a creature is ruled out as being extinct, you don't always have to say that that is the end of the subject. The future has a knack of throwing up totally unexpected facets related to subjects of this nature, and Flores Man is a great example of that. And now, with reports of this elusive miniature humanoid of modern times, the Ebugogu, perhaps the Hobbit, as you say in inverted commas, perhaps the Hobbit has actually survived to the present day. It's very similar to another entity, the famous Orang Pendek of Sumatra, which again is not a million miles away from Flores, again in Indonesia, another island in Indonesia. And I think the Orang Pendek, the short man, a bipedal entity, hairy bipedal entity, about 3 feet or so tall, that there is so much good evidence for that. Hair samples have been obtained that can't be identified with any known species. Footprints have been obtained, casts of footprints that don't match those of any known species. I think there is a great deal of good evidence for the reality of Orang Pendek. And I think if I was asked what is the most likely major unknown animal to be discovered in the future, I think I would have to say the Orang Pendek stands a very good chance of being that creature.
Well, while we're on the topic of bipedal sort of primates, undiscovered species, let's talk about Bigfoot for a second, or
yep.
Sasquatch.
Yep.
You don't write about that in this book, but I just get your take on it. I saw a quote from, in just the last week, from Sir David Attenborough, who said he thinks it's a pretty good possibility that Yeti is real, that it was a real creature or is a real creature. We have some scientists here who've been studying hair samples, unidentified DNA. I am told that there's a guy at Oxford now who's been studying some of the same samples. Is it possible that this suddenly would become an acceptable line of inquiry, that it would be respectable to go ahead and explore this whole idea about a Bigfoot? Or is it preposterous on its face that it could exist out there somewhere?
I think what people have to take into account, when you think of remote areas, you tend to think of, you know, tropical rainforests, New Guinea, Madagascar, South America, that kind of thing. People don't realize, unless they've perhaps actually ever flown over the Pacific Northwest, Canada, the vast areas of forest and woodland. They mightn't be tropical rainforest, but they are so vast. I always feel that it's impossible to say that something couldn't exist in an area as vast and uncharted as that, because it's just nonsense. You know, you're talking hundreds of square miles of dense forest, where the animals that live in these forests, that is their domain, and if they don't want to be seen, they will not be seen. So to begin with, on that score alone, I would be very hesitant in saying, you know, that something cannot exist. As far as Bigfoot itself is concerned, true, it would be a totally novel addition to the North American fauna, an unknown species of primate, if it were discovered to be a known a species of primate. It's a question of, you know, where are all its relatives? How did he get to North America? Did he get across the Bering land bridge when North America was connected to Asia? All of that is important to take into account. But with DNA studies now, I think DNA has been a very useful tool to unlock a lot of mysteries concerning the classification of animals, and in so doing, helping cryptozoology to decide what a certain creature can and can't be. Because the old days, you had to have an entire carcass, or at least a goodly remains of one, to really provide physical evidence for the reality of something. Now, if you can obtain DNA samples, you can get a good idea of what that creature is, or at least what it isn't, which is just as important. And therefore, with Bigfoot and Sasquatch, the DNA evidence that people are starting to put forward claims for DNA and so forth, I think in the future this could throw up some very interesting results. In fact, it has already started to throw up some quite curious results. The Yeti, moving away just briefly from Bigfoot, the Yeti, I think David Attenborough, as you say, Sir David, stated that he thinks it's a possibility. As he rightly said in the interview, you've got vast amounts of rhododendron forest at high altitudes. Creatures could live there without ever being seen properly, more than just a fleeting glimpse, for centuries, for millennia. And there are complete ecosystems living in the rhododendron forest. So the Yeti would not be a major surprise in terms of, oh, you know, how could we have missed a creature like that very easily in vast, relatively inaccessible regions like that. So that's why I think, you know, Sir David kind of leans favourably towards the reality of the Yeti, because it is a not-so-unlikely creature in an area where its elusiveness can be readily explained.
Is there an explanation that would be acceptable to mainstream zoologists why bones for these kind of creatures have never been found?
Well, again, you know, the vastness of North America. If right. when a creature dies, the ecosystem gets to work very, very quickly. The animal decomposes, it's eaten, it's scavenged by scavenging species. The bones are buried very, very rapidly. Leaves fall, leaf litter and so forth covers the area very, very rapidly, and it would be looking like for a needle in a haystack, as the expression goes. I mean, there are devices and so forth that you can actually use that can find. Paleontology uses it for finding fossil evidence beneath the surface. You know, you could use that kind of technology. But again, where do you begin? Where on earth do you begin? In a lot of cryptozoology has happened by accident, flukes, lucky discoveries, and I feel that is probably going to be a good way of finding it. It's very haphazard, but one day someone will just come upon the remains of one of these creatures, and once that happens, you know, bang, you have the mystery solved, because you have the physical evidence that you need to analyse. But, you know, you're talking North America is a pretty large area of the world. It's like, you know, if you wanted to find the remains of a cougar, for example, could you just go out and know exactly where to look and find a dead cougar? Could you find even a dead deer? It's not the easiest of things to do. And when you're talking about a creature that is, by definition, as elusive as Bigfoot or Sasquatch, if you're going to look for anything like that, where do you begin to look?
I remember reading, you know, about meteorites, about these French peasants in the 1600s, 1700s, who were reporting rocks falling from the sky, and the scientists at the time said, ah, you're crazy. You natives don't know what you're talking about. And, of course, meteorites, you know, became an established fact and a scientific discipline. I would imagine, you know, you can't automatically discard the opinions of the natives, the people who live next to these areas, the people, places that are like hot spots of weird creatures, Madagascar, the Congo. You can't automatically dismiss their reports as being mythology, because it sometimes turns out to be true.
Oh, absolutely. As I said earlier, you know, one of my previous books is Encyclopedia of New and Rediscovered Animals, and time again, there are, you know, several hundred cases in there. All the famous animals, okapi, mountain gorilla, the Wukong ox or saolar, which is a buffalo-like creature discovered as recently as the 1990s in Vietnam. All of these creatures, scientists were brought to their attention by the local people saying, oh, we know such and such an animal, and eventually they they've been able to find some horns or skin or something like that. Time and time again, that has been the pathway to finding the animal. The Vukrang Oxys Sao La, as it's pronounced in Vietnamese, discovered in 1992. The scientists who were in the area at the time, they weren't looking for it, they didn't know anything about it, but they were shown these gigantic, very long antelope-like horns by some of the local hunters who kept them as trophies. And as soon as the scientists looked at them, they knew there was no scientifically known animal in Vietnam, indeed in the whole of Asia, that had horns like that. So they knew immediately they were onto something big. And so then it was a case of they were asking the hunters, could you bring us any more remains? Could you show us one of these creatures? And bit by bit, the creature was shown to be real. A skin was obtained of one, and they knew exactly now what it looked like, totally unknown to science, completely separate species, and eventually a few were captured and filmed alive. It's an endangered species, but we do know it exists. The area where it was found is now a protected area, and so I think we found the Vukrang Oxys Sao La just in time. Perhaps a few more years, had the scientists not taken notice of the locals, I think the creature would be extinct. So it would have lived and died and never been known to science, almost like Sukotaro.
I imagine you must get it from both sides, though. There are scientists, regular zoologists, who don't approve of you chasing after these legends and myths, even if your results come back to prove what their beliefs were to begin with. But you also must get it from the true believers who wanted sea serpents to be real, who want these dinosaurs to exist in the Congo, and they don't want to hear your explanations that are contrary to those beliefs.
Oh, again, yeah, absolutely. As you say, it's walking a very tight line between the true believers and the absolute non-believers. And, you know, you can't please everyone, but all you can do, as with any scientific discipline, is look for the evidence, examine the evidence, and try and draw conclusions from the evidence. You have to follow where the evidence takes you. You don't have to have presuppositions. You don't think, oh, well, it's definitely so-and-so, and then you find some evidence, and you try and twist the evidence to match your preconception. You can't do it. It has to be the other way. You know, if you think it's such and such a creature and the evidence suggests that it's not, well, you have to say, okay, well, my theory is wrong. Let's come up with a new theory based upon what we have and take it from there.
You have some places that are sort of hot spots that are mentioned again and again in your book, Mirabilis, places like Madagascar. I imagine the Galapagos is because these are places where weird creatures evolve.
Yeah, well, Madagascar is literally a complete island continent to itself. It might be not too far from the coastline of mainland Africa, but its animals are, you know, a little world all to itself. You have the lemurs there. You have all sorts of species of birds and reptiles there that are just not found anywhere else because Madagascar separated from Africa many millions of years ago, and the creatures that have been that were isolated on Madagascar have gone their own way in terms of development, evolution, whatever, have just transformed into creatures totally unlike anything found anywhere else. And so obviously you not only have the unique known animals there, you have the unique unknown animals, because there is a huge vast data bank, as it were, of folklore, of folk tales, and also of cryptozoology. And once again, there are stories of cryptozoology that were shown to be correct. The giant bird, the Vompatra, it was called in Madagascan folklore. The Vompatra was a giant ostrich-like creature that laid enormous eggs and was also said to fly through the sky and actually kidnap elephants from the mainland and take them away. And it all seemed to be very nonsensical.
Carl, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. Dr. Carl Schuker is our guest. When we come back, I want to jump into some of the stories that are not only associated with crypto creatures, but also with famous people. Julius Caesar, Christopher Columbus are two examples. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.